You're tuned into Met Radio CJTM 1280 AM in downtown Toronto for the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Mia Johnson. Since Bill 98 came into the legislature, it has gotten torn apart in every which way. For its changes to Toronto green building policies, communal water and wastewater systems, and what would look like a complete TTC takeover. All of those changes are worth talking about. But there's one policy change that's gone overlooked by journalists, voters, and candidates. At least that's what local housing advocate Damien Moule told us.
You describe Bill 98 as the biggest change to municipal land use planning in decades. What makes it more significant than previous provincial housing reforms?
I would point to two things, I think. One, and the biggest practical impact is going to be that minimum lot size area is about to be capped. And that sounds very technical and boring, but what it means in practice is that throughout Toronto's residential neighborhoods, lot subdivision will be allowed basically everywhere. And then second from that, I think it marks the end of the current official plan as it's written as part of Bill 98.
There is one official city document that tells us which buildings are allowed where, how big they are, how tall, guiding decisions around transportation, infrastructure, and community facilities. This document is called Toronto's official plan. Official plans are a city's most important document, as they act as a roadmap for urban planning and development in a municipality. And under the new law, it will need to be rewritten. It would be the largest change to municipal land use planning Ontario's seen in decades. Blah, right? But with elections around the corner, that means it would be rewritten under new leadership, which will have a hand in electing. Damien Moule, he's been following this. He is a volunteer for the pro-housing advocacy group More Neighbors, a group that's championed increasing urban density throughout the city. When we got to talking with Moule, he told us there's a lot riding on this. Writing a new official plan is a once-in-a-generation exercise.
The official plan is, I think, the most important document that the City of Toronto produces. It governs how land use planning is done, and I think land use planning is the most important thing the City of Toronto does. So I think the people who are about to be elected will have a massive amount of control over not just what happens during their term, but over the next 25 years or longer of land use in Toronto. And I don't think anybody really knows that that's what they're being elected to do, but it is. And so I think more people need to be asking candidates about what they think the next official plan should look like. A lot of people seem unhappy with tall and sprawl or various features of our current development application process. And now is the time to change it. And you don't get this very often. You get it once a generation. So it's incredibly important. And I think your listeners should think about what they think is important, and they should be asking candidates about what they think are important.
Just over 3,000 residents took part in a study on the state of Toronto's culture today. The engagement report was submitted to the City of Toronto and the Council of Arts in 2024. And these community consultations would go on to inform the city's action plan for culture over the next 10 years. The report finds that many of the key issues identified in the previous plan, which was published in 2011, continue to plague Toronto, and some have even worsened. What's listed is the loss of cultural spaces and venues, rapid technology shifts, and inequitable wages, among other things.
You know, I grew up in Leslieville, and I've definitely watched the demographics change. I've watched Queen Street East turn into, a brunching spot, and the coffee there's great and the thrifting can be really good, but it's different than when I was going to elementary school there, you know?
That is Maya Taruk-Pilling, a master's student of communication and culture at Toronto Metropolitan University. She's currently writing her thesis on the impact of gentrification on small live music venues in Toronto.
Look at all this culture in the downtown core. And the more that that is commodified and sold to people, the less that it really exists and the less that those people who created that culture can afford to live there. And so I think we see this happening all throughout the city.
What was written in that engagement report, the one I mentioned earlier about the state of culture in Toronto today, what was documented was this: Torontonians are struggling not only to thrive, but simply to survive. And many are finding it hard to create and engage with arts and culture.
There are a lot of spaces, I believe, that could benefit from housing and that they should not inherently come at the cost of what makes those spaces worth living for.
And maybe something we look back and say, you know what, we kind of screwed up in the 2020s. And we were so gung-ho to accommodate more housing that we threw the baby out with the bathwater. And look at what we've done.
Blair Scorgi is a registered professional planner, urban designer, and managing principal of Scorgi Planning. His job is to advise developers on land use policies, zoning laws, and local development rules. With the province's rapid-fire approach to introducing new legislation we've been seeing lately, Scorgi said it's difficult for municipalities and planning consultants like himself to keep pace.
Yeah, I think there's a real risk that we're moving pretty hard and pretty fast with these things, and that there are going to be adverse impacts that we're only starting to figure out that will take years to fully materialize. But there's also the possibility of course correction down the road, right?
So to recap, the province wants municipalities to standardize their official plans, this huge document. So what does a universal standard for zoning province-wide look like? And what kinds of questions should we be asking our urban leaders?
It may, in the case of Toronto in particular, it may mean that certain designations are lost or need to be reorganized into other designations to meet the intent of provincial policy. It may mean the loss of some nuance at the municipal level in terms of the things that we regulate. So an example I like to use is in the city of Toronto, we have designations that other municipalities don't have. One is the regeneration areas designation. Mm-hmm. That was introduced in, you know, the 1990s to and this is difficult to imagine today, but to spur investment in the areas surrounding King and Parliament on the East End and King and Spadina in the West End, which, believe it or not, were suffering economically for decades. This designation allowed for a great amount of flexibility to occur, and it incentivized and catalyzed a lot of development and is part of the reason we have such a vibrant downtown today. But that designation doesn't meet the qualifications or requirements of this particular framework. So it will either be lost or will have to be reorganized. So these are some of the big questions that cities like Toronto will have to grapple with.
Mm-hmm. Before the whole idea of standardization came into play, all planning at the municipal level had to conform or be consistent with the Planning Act. What worked about that and what doesn't? Or is that an efficient framework?
So just to be clear, that will continue to be the requirement moving forward.
Okay.
This latest piece of legislation, this bill, is just sort of the latest iteration of that. So that will continue to be the requirement moving forward. I would say that where it works well is if there's very clear direction and a very sort of clear and robust set of rules and regulations that are intended to establish a baseline at the provincial level. It's the mechanism by which the province is able to implement its planning-based mandate. And so it's very efficient from a top-down planning perspective, if that's the objective. From the municipal perspective, it's generally not, you know, unheard of that policies like the official plan or zoning bylaw regulations need to be updated and reviewed periodically. Typically, they're reviewed and updated every 5 to 10 years to ensure that they're in compliance with provincial policy.
Yeah.
But when individual pieces of legislation like Bill 98 are introduced, they place specific deadlines. There's a transition period here for the City of Toronto specifically.
Yeah.
That sets a deadline, creates a sense of urgency, and requires a fairly timely response from municipalities that may be and likely are juggling many different things at the same time.
Yeah.
And where it becomes problematic is when we have a large frequency of change occurring, you know, over a finite period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And where this administration differs from some of its predecessors is that where it might have been historically quite common for new pieces of legislation to be introduced, perhaps once a year or once every couple of years, that impact official plan policies, zoning bylaws, the planning profession at large,
mm-hmm.
this administration is introducing changes fairly rapidly. So rapidly that it's causing difficulty in municipalities being able to achieve their obligations and meet their statutory deadlines to implement these types of changes. The province has already, at one or multiple points, scaled back and changed the rules and the regulations governing site plan control, which is not zoning, but it's something that comes after zoning for larger developments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the thought is, well, do we need to take this back and rethink the entire strategy around the zoning bylaw? And we don't want to do this. I think a lot of people would say zoning is best left high level, simple, clear rules, regulations that everyone can follow. But this almost incentivizes putting like design controls into zoning that don't currently exist, that putting the types of controls into zoning that you might otherwise see at the site plan level, because you can't rely on site plan to the same extent that you would have otherwise. And so it creates a bottleneck earlier in the process, or it likely will, I would imagine. And it makes the municipality less likely to create open and flexible zoning regulations because they want to maintain some element of control over the outcomes. And if they no longer have that at site plan, they're going to have to ensure that they have it at zoning.
Yeah. In terms of the number of reports and studies that the city is being asked to cut in half,
mm-hmm.
also council no longer being able to ask for shadow studies, you know, we talked about having the city having control and having control over the outcome. Like, what are the accountability concerns there? And then in terms of maintaining municipal autonomy, that's something that's mm-hmm. been sort of threatened recently with, you know, we have other examples outside of zoning like Billy Bishop Airport or the speed cameras, but more relevant to this discussion, like the inclusionary zoning, the pause on that for affordable mm-hmm. housing builds. So yeah, what are the accountability concerns? And then
is municipal autonomy under threat here?
All right, so the province is scaling back green building standards,
mm-hmm.
sustainability standards like that, environmental standards, but it's also scaling back design standards and the ability of municipalities to use certain tools like shadow studies. And, you know, my urban design counterparts are quite upset about this because it's an erosion of municipal authority over design control. And again, this actually relates to the conversation we just had about site plan control.
Yeah.
Exterior design is something that the province has previously scaled back municipal authority through revisions to site plan control. It used to be, up until a couple of years ago, that the city could regulate exterior design to a certain extent through design control, not through Bill 98, but through other previous pieces of legislation. That authority has previously been scaled back to accessibility standards and sustainability standards. And through Bill 98, it's been further scaled back to the point at which the city can still have, you know, something like a green roof bylaw, for example, and can still enforce it. But beyond that, other pieces of what was referred to as the Toronto Green Standard, you know, and the various tiers of it, can no longer be made mandatory. You know, there are certain things that the city can continue to regulate and certain things that they cannot. Because the provincial government has hollowed out design controls through site plan control, a lot of the things that might have been mandatory in the Toronto Green Standard, the city may still ask for and may still say that they require, but the legislative underpinning that allowed them to enforce it is no longer going to be there. To talk about the shadow studies in particular, though, it goes beyond urban design. It makes it difficult for me to do my job as a planner and for the city's planning department to do its job, and by extension for city council to do its job, is to determine impact and the whether or not adverse impact is contemplated as a result of change. And as a planner, my responsibility is actually not to my clients, it's to the public interest, whatever that is, right? And that's not necessarily a singular thing either. So as a planning consultant, it's difficult for me to do my job because it's absent information like, say, a shadow study. It's difficult for me to understand the extent of impact on neighboring surrounding properties and the resulting impact that that may have on the quality of life of the people that live around a project. What shadow studies do give us a sense of is access to natural light, sky views, sunlight. All these things are important for people's mental well-being and quality of life. And so if we're not able to assess that, if we can't require that documentation, it's difficult to say that we've completely done our jobs and undertaken a robust analysis of an application to the point at which we feel that we can support it. Mm-hmm. From a planning perspective, to say that it represents good planning. So that's the challenge I have. And so what may happen is municipalities may continue to ask for these things, and certain developers may just provide them in the interest of, you know, building a relationship with staff and working with staff. Others may be more defiant and say, we're not required by provincial legislation. We're not going to do that. Municipalities may then turn around and say, that's fine, but we're having a very difficult time assessing your development. And because this information is absent, perhaps we are more likely to err on the side of saying it may cause adverse impacts than we would if you actually just provided us with the information and the data and assured us that it doesn't. Beyond that, it may also result in work being done by municipalities in place of the applicants, which may be fine, but then applicants may actually prefer to retain control over the outcome of those processes and ensure that they're done appropriately. Not that municipalities would do them improperly, but, you know, they're almost in a way they're giving up the ability to demonstrate and to make a case for something. It may shift responsibilities. It may muddy the waters a little bit. And ultimately, it may not save time, and it may make it more difficult to properly assess applications on their merits.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the sort of speed and intensity at which changes are coming to municipalities. Like, the province has given the city a deadline to implement its new zoning regulations for major transit stations, which you spoke about a bit earlier. Now, municipalities are being hit with this new batch of changes. At the speed and intensity at which changes are coming, what kind of pressure does that now put on the planning system?
It puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the planning system, because every time one of these changes is introduced, the planning department of the City of Toronto, for example, has to reassess every active project it's working on and how it's impacted by these changes. It makes it challenging to address the immediate priorities, but it also has the potential risk of delaying other priorities. And then you introduce things like an election year on top of that, you know, then we're talking about a summer recess, a blackout period for politicians. They're not going to throw anything significant at them in October, November. So you're talking about delaying major decisions on things until probably December or January. It's also just very difficult for municipalities and even consultants to keep up with what the rules are this week when they're constantly changing. And so it creates a lot of uncertainty for municipalities. It creates a lot of uncertainty for lawyers, for planning consultants, for our clients, for the general public, because the goalposts are constantly shifting, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not even about, like, what has changed because of this one piece of legislation. It's about what has changed in light of this legislation compounded by the introduction of 5, 6, 7 different other pieces of legislation in the last year. How do you read them together? If you read between the lines, city legal will tell you that certain things are implied by multiple pieces of legislation being read together that may not be obvious if you're looking at one piece of legislation in isolation.
I'm imagining, like, a board and then just, like, yarn and, like, trying to connect.
Well, yeah, it's the detective murder board. Yeah, it's a spider web of mess that needs to be sorted out. And the more you add to it, the more you're piling on, right?
I want to go back to the basics for just a second. Like, okay, the simplest terms, if you could explain what the official plan is and why it matters to planners, like what function does it serve in the city's like underbelly?
Okay. So the official plan is the overarching municipal land use policy document of every municipality, including the City of Toronto. It deals with the disposition of lands and how they are to be used. So it applies different land use categories. So examples could be residential, employment, mixed use, commercial. Those would apply to swaths of land throughout a municipality and collectively address every parcel of land in a municipality. So every parcel of land is designated something, has a land use designation, in other words.
Yeah.
On top of that, there may be sort of core structuring elements of municipal policy that are embedded in the official plan. So in Toronto, we refer to these as the urban structure policies, and we have special designations that are read on top of and in conjunction with land use designations, but deal more with the city's urban structure. And so the downtown and central waterfront is one urban structure designation. Another is the centers. So the centers are Yonge and Eglinton, Scarborough Center, Etobicoke Center, and North York Center. Those are the centers. They have specific policy designations. They're intended for things that other areas of the city are not intended for. Okay. Another layer is the avenues. So these are some of our, it's a sub-designation of our major streets, which are also identified in the official plan. Hmm. But the avenues are a subset of these major streets that are intended to intensify in the form of mixed-use, low- to mid-rise development over the lifespan of the plan. And so these include, you know, Queen Street, King Street, Eglinton Avenue,
yeah,
you know,
I live
Shepherd,
on an avenue,
et
cetera. Yeah.
You live on an avenue? Many of us do, because that's actually where the City of Toronto is targeting a lot of growth, is on its avenues. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, serviced, they tend to be not contiguously, but they're commercial main streets. They are mixed use in nature. They may have residential pockets. Mm-hmm. They have pirate or transit, streetcars, subways, that kind of thing. They have access to amenities like parks and open spaces and schools. They're close to, you know, they're in or on the edges of neighborhoods, many of them anyway. And so this is where a lot of these services, infrastructure, and amenities exist to support growth. For that reason, this is one place the city is targeting growth. Another urban structure designation is the employment areas. And so these are protected areas for employment purposes only. You actually cannot build residential uses in employment areas. And they are protected because of their economic benefits and the fact that we're not building any more of them. So a great example of that is I live in Leslieville, just immediately north of Eastern Avenue.
Love and, Leslieville. Great neighborhood.
And the area south of Eastern Avenue is one of the city's most important employment areas, and it's very delicate. It's production and post-production studios for the film industry and the television industry. And it requires relatively inexpensive land because the industry can only afford rents that are so high. It requires generally low-rise development with large consolidated pieces of land to build studio spaces and production facilities. It requires access to very popular film scenes like downtown Toronto and my block, which is absolutely always being filmed.
Hey guys, haven't seen you all summer. How are you doing?
Paige?
New year, new look, new Paige.
It requires access to, you know, the highway system and the transit system, because we need to be able to get, you know, our equipment and our people in and out, right? So there are only so many places where that type of use can exist. And I'm just using it as an example, but it's very fragile. And if we were to destabilize it by introducing residential and high density residential permissions in particular, land values would go up. You know, we can't control rents. So like rents would go up and the economic impact could be significant, because despite the fact that it's fairly fragile and what it can take and what it requires, the economic impact of that industry is tremendous and it's of national significance. But the official plan also gets into, you know, higher order transit, network expansion, bicycle infrastructure, major streets, environmentally sensitive areas, parks and open spaces, prominent views, and all, like all kinds of stuff is baked into the official plan policy. It talks about built form, talks about massing, talks about urban design. There are detailed policies associated with each of the land uses and urban structure designations. There's all kinds of stuff in there. And so to go back to your earlier question about, you know, Bill 98, well, the official plan might actually be at the point where it makes sense to rethink it anyway. On an iterative basis, it's been revised and expanded over the last sort of 30 years. But this current version of the official plan that we're working with is a behemoth of a document, and it is about 30 years old. And some of the thinking is out of date, and through iterative review, it has been revised to reflect that. But I think on the positive side, it's maybe not a bad time to rethink it at a high level anyway. The downside is that, because it's kind of lived its functional life, to be honest with you, the downside is, you're putting tremendous pressure on a very busy department, the largest department of the City of Toronto, to fundamentally rebuild this document, and you're putting them under a very tight timeline. January 2028 is effectively a year and a half away, and that's not a lot of time to reimagine and reconstruct the city's most important policy document.
Toronto is a very densely populated city. How would applying a universal standard across the board benefit small towns? I know your focus is on Toronto, so we can focus on Toronto here, but like, how does that work?
I think the objective is standardization, which you kind of pointed at. It certainly would make it easier for practitioners to operate in different jurisdictions if there was a standardized framework, right? I kind of market myself as a Toronto expert from the planning consultancy side of things, in part because the policy and the regulatory framework in Toronto is extremely nuanced and extremely complicated and significantly different from many other jurisdictions. But the flip side of that is that despite the fact that I have a general sense of how official plan documents are structured, how zoning bylaw regulations are structured in the province of Ontario, and there are already like very high level requirements that everybody has to meet, there's quite a bit of nuance and distinction between them. Certainly standardization would make it easier for practitioners and, you know, like including planning consultants, but also land developers actually to work in these different jurisdictions. It would also make it easier for municipal bureaucrats to pivot from one role in one jurisdiction to another. And I'm reading between the lines. I don't know this definitively, but there is quite a bit of nuance, as I mentioned, in official plan documents from one municipality to another. Some of the stuff that's in these official plan documents, the province might have already said, isn't really defensible from a provincial planning perspective or doesn't directly meet the intent of provincial policy. This may be a way of reining those municipalities in. I think this government also just believes in creating very clear and simple rules, despite the fact that of everything I've just described to you and how their quick and dirty moves complicate the process for everybody involved. But I think the hope is that the outcome of all of this is that everyone has the same baseline understanding of what the rules are. It's all very clear what you can do, what you cannot do, and you know what is defendable from a legislative perspective versus what is not. So for example, I used the regeneration areas designation earlier. You know, what does that become? And maybe that's an example of something that's kind of lived its functional life, and maybe it's okay to lose it. But there may be other things like that that are unique to Toronto or important to Toronto. I mean, you know, there are very important cultural institutions and uses here that are at risk. The Sneaky D's example is an interesting one, but like music venues in general being wiped off the map because of land economics being what they are, because of the need for housing, et cetera, et cetera. There are certain protections that the City of Toronto has put in place for certain types of uses that it risks losing.
What are some of the protections that they could risk losing?
Yeah. My one question I go to is, we have this community, Little Jamaica, that sort of straddles Eglinton Avenue West. It's recently been identified as a cultural heritage district. And there are certain sort of protections in place that are unique to it. Are they going to survive this? I don't know the answer to that. I think people in city legal are asking questions like this, like if we're restricted in what we can regulate through policy, does that impact other things down the line? And also when we're losing other tools like site plan control, does that place greater responsibility on us at the policy level to ensure certain things too, right? Environmental protections are being gutted from site plan control, as are design protections, as we have discussed. Does the city have the authority to bolster their urban design policies in the official plan, or are they also at risk? And they likely are to some degree. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do we risk losing our ability to secure certain design objectives through policy, you know, or is there an opportunity to bolster that in light of losing it through site plan control? These are the types of questions that I think are being asked right now.
Yeah, the cultural heritage aspect is really interesting because we just were following what was happening at Sneaky D's. They were looking into cultural heritage status because that wasn't something that they had. And we were talking to a master's student who was doing her, she was doing her thesis on gentrification in the city, talking a lot about how Yorkville has changed, like how it used to be this sort of like incubator for folk music. So really,
hippies.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like the Opera House. It wasn't like Danforth Music Hall. These weren't like huge sit down things. These were small businesses that also had their doors open to musicians to try stuff.
Maya Taruk-Pilling, master's student of communication and culture at Toronto Metropolitan University.
There were about 40 operational music venues, 40 plus, in the height of Yorkdale's folk scene, which is a number that is unheard of nowadays, let alone in one neighborhood. And Yorkville's not a big neighborhood. It's right in one of like the densest parts of the city.
Yeah.
But back then, people made that space into something that was accessible for musicians.
Night in the city looks pretty to me. Night in the city looks fine.
Because they had the means to, you know, business owners could keep their doors open a little bit later on, or they could take a chance on a smaller artist that weren't necessarily going to draw in a 50 plus crowd. You know, there was maybe less of that guarantee, but the way that rent worked out and the way that people mobilized in that era, especially in the pushback against the Vietnam War, in the push toward greater civil rights for more people in the States and in Canada, there was what I believe was this counterculture that was alive.
Well, I'm up in Teal. He can jive alive.
They had the means to do that because the state of the city allowed for it.
But the subways are empty. So are the cafes.
That's a bit of a tangent, but just really interesting to see how things change and how fast they do change.
And that's an interesting point too, because, you know, my immediate gut response from the outcome of the Sneaky D's thing was momentum is changing. We have lost so many important cultural, you know, institutions over the years, you know, even just things that are unique to Toronto's identity in general, right? Like the closing of, the Imperial Pub, right? The longest serving pub in the city of Toronto.
Yeah.
Open for like 80 something years to make way for TMU's new, like, you know, building, right? We've got Sam the Record Man on Yonge Street. We lost, you know, we've lost all kinds of different
Silver Dollar Room.
Yeah, like, you know, maybe people would say, you know, Honest Ed's was filled with trash.
There's no place like this place, any place. The world-famous bargain house, Honest Ed's. Honest Ed's is a drugstore, appliance store, sporting goods store, grocery store.
They say Honest Ed's a freak just because I have bargains coming out of my ears.
But on the other hand, like, these are things that are unique to our civic identity. And whether you are a patron of Honest Ed's or not, you know, these are local landmarks and cultural landmarks and destinations and part of what makes Toronto unique and special. And, And then there are the things that are not the landmarks that also play an important role that are kind of underground, or they're just things that are getting priced out because of the way that land economics is working, right? And there's been so much of that. Like the entire entertainment district has been gutted over the last 20 years and replaced by condos, right? and moved and turned into a club district. You know, so much of that kind of stuff has happened over the last 20, 30 years that I've been here. And it's the first time I've seen a major project like that actually stopped. And the fact that they were considering further steps, cultural heritage designation. Yeah. Imagine if that opportunity was taken away from them, right? Mm. All of a sudden that momentum could start to change where we have important communities like Little Jamaica that deserve to be protected. We could risk sterilizing communities by getting rid of some of these protections, right?
Yeah. I think that definitely quality of life and preserving a cultural identity in Toronto would seem to me as important to at least the people that I talk to on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think there's a real risk that we're moving pretty hard and pretty fast with these things and that there are going to be adverse impacts that we're only starting to figure out that will take years to fully materialize. But there's also the possibility of course correction down the road, right? This guy's Doug. I've met Doug. I know Doug. I know he's not particularly popular anymore. He may be on the way out and, somebody is going to come back in and replace him. And things change, and change is the only constant. And so who knows if the next administration just completely flips this entire thing on its head in another couple of years. That could very well be the case, right? Yeah. We just don't know. It's difficult, I think, to create a one-size-fits-all solution for anything. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's what a lot of standards are at the provincial level. They're a one-size-fits-all solution to things, and that is the direction this administration has been pushing things more and more is a one-size-fits-all solution. Whereas the city of Toronto in particular and large municipalities up until this point have been used to having a bit more flexibility and a little bit of grace for a bit of nuance, and that is now being taken away. So I think this is probably at a very high level a set of policies and regulations that probably stand to benefit smaller municipalities that are resource constrained and staff constrained. But the challenge will be in these larger municipalities, how to adapt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about sort of some of the negatives, the potential negatives that could come out of reworking an official plan. You mentioned that there's some outdated things. What are some of the things that we might be leaving in the past that would be good?
Well, the neighborhood policies are written in such a way that quite a bit of deference is paid to existing established residents at the expense of potential future residents. And, neighborhood character policies that try to control the scale, the massing, the typology of buildings, the setbacks, the landscaping, all these types of things. It's quite a detailed amount of, policy for an official plan document. It's a lot to put it into an official plan document to begin with, to regulate at that level. But it also has the impact of limiting change in neighborhoods, right? And so over the last few years, we have started to carve away at that. The Expanding Housing Options and Neighborhoods Initiative has taken off. We now have garden suite permissions citywide. We now have multiplex permissions citywide across all neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. We have permissions for sixplexes in certain wards of the city in neighborhoods. We have permissions for apartment buildings up to six stories or townhouses up to four stories on major streets throughout the city of Toronto. And we now, most recently, have permissions for neighborhood retail and service uses in neighborhoods that have been, up until this point, this year, in fact, regulated almost out of existence. That's a pretty significant paradigm shift. Because we're allowed to build multiplexes and laneway suites and garden suites and all of them. The only distinguishing factor now is in some you can have semi-detached dwellings and some you can't. And some you can have townhouses and some you can't. And some you can have low-rise apartment buildings and some you can't. But you know what? The direction we're going is that you can have all of those things pretty much everywhere. But it's being introduced through exceptions. And so the underlying policy direction that attempts to limit those things is still baked into the official plan.
Okay.
And only through a comprehensive rewrite of the official plan will it be eliminated.
So we talked about how a lot of this stuff and there's a lot happening, is going to get dumped sort of on the next council. A new council members could shake things up a little bit, could change the direction of where we go, what exceptions get through, what doesn't. This would be the biggest change to municipal land use planning Ontario's seen in decades. So some housing advocates have told me that this should be an election issue. They've said it's been largely overlooked by candidates, voters, even journalists, not to their own fault, but because there's a lot going on. What do you make of this argument? And do you think this kind of planning reform is a bigger deal than it's being made out to be?
I think it's a very big deal. The public has the right to understand what's happening and vote accordingly. So in this case, we're talking about something that is beyond municipal control. It's being directed by the province, but the way that it's addressed and implemented is to some degree within municipal control. And there likely are various ways that could be approached. And there may be solutions, genuine solutions to addressing the intent of this policy change. Generally speaking, I'm generally of the feeling that everybody should have a better baseline understanding of what's happening in their backyard. I know that a lot of people find municipal politics to be boring or city planning to be very dry. It is. It can be. But these things are very important. And the implications of this are significant. Mm-hmm. Again, to some extent, this is out of our control, but it is something that is going to have to be addressed in the next year and a half, as I said, this official plan reform. And so it's a question of not if, but how. And to answer the how, I think it's very important that we have meaningful public consultation, right? This isn't something that should just, and it won't just rest on, the thoughts of bureaucrats. Community consultation is baked into the process. It's also a requirement of the Planning Act. But the earlier people understand these things and can wrap their heads around it, I think the better. And the extent to which this can inform discourse by future decision makers, policymakers, in the form of, ward councillors who may be elected, I think it's incumbent upon them to understand these things. Mm-hmm. I think constituents have a right and a need to understand that and to vote accordingly, right? To make an informed decision.
Thank you so much, Blair.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Blair Scorgi is a registered professional planner, urban designer, and managing principal of Scorgi Planning. This coverage would not be possible without the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. Additional reporting for this episode was done by fellow local journalist Kinza Safar. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Mia Johnson.